Begin a new book of the week. On Silbury Hill by Adam Thorpe is an unusual blend of history, memoir, archaeology and speculation. Part celebration, part investigation. It's one man's story of a life inextricably linked to a mysterious and ancient mound set in the Wiltshire countryside. The reader is Philip Franks.
The point about Silbury Hill is that she has no point. She has been described as standing in the Kennet Meadows like a grassed-over coal tip. A sudden doubter, I spent an hour on the web searching for images of abandoned spoil tips. None of them resembled Silbury. Silbury is the more beautiful for being almost ugly. I have known her since the age of 13. She is the largest man-made hill in Europe, and only beaten elsewhere by the tomb of Aliates near Sardis in Turkey. At around 130 feet high, she is equivalent to a 13-storey building. If the Titanic sailed just behind her in your dreams, you would only see the smoke from the funnels. If the Statue of Liberty could be placed likewise, only the bronze flame of the torch would poke above the flattish summit. Her base covers 5 acres of Wiltshire turf, the equivalent of 3 football pitches, 5 acres that have not seen sunlight or stars for some 4,300 years, and will never see sunlight again until, possibly, the ice of the next ice age scratches her away like a pimple. In her day, she must have been almost unimaginably colossal, since nothing else man-made came anywhere near. She was probably as white when completed as the dome of the Taj Mahal, not with marble, but with ungrassed chalk. To visitors seeing her for the first time, she would have seemed otherworldly, miraculous, impossibly smooth and symmetrical. It is probable that the scooped-out ditch left around her by the construction was naturally flooded like a moat, giving her a mirroring surround. Oddly, almost incredibly given our surfeited imagination, our seen-it-all consciousness, her heap of grassy chalk still seems otherworldly. She rears up quite abruptly as you drive westward on the A4, or the Bath Road, from Marlborough, slightly sunken beyond the spur that the road has followed for at least 2,000 years, and always surprising. Yet without someone standing at her base, or, now forbidden, on top of her, to give us a comparison, her scale grows blurred. From the viewing area by the little car park, she seems almost too small, almost a grassy knoll. A giant knoll, but still a knoll. Walk the path towards Weydon Hill, then climb until you can look across and down at her, not too far, or the crest of the hill begins to swallow her up. And what happens? She grows into something gigantic. Is it just me? Or does she seem to be expanding, swelling, like a speeded-up pregnancy? And I'm not even persuaded by the great goddess theory, or no more than by all the other theories. Deep in the 1970s, I read Michael Dames's book, The Silbury Treasure. I was seduced. The author gives the impression that he has unlocked something, doing it so well and evocatively that even if you doubt his explanation, you want him to be right. His diagrams, evoking parallel images of ancient Venus figurines, of a great all-seeing eyeball or a pregnant belly, make it seem blatantly obvious that Silbury is a massive sculpture of Mother Earth nearly at her term, a gigantic harvest hill gouged and heaped from the low-lying terrain as an honouring of the soil's natural fertility. As I had always seen Silbury as her, the seduction was swift. At the beginning of our own millennium, after weeks of heavy rain, a large hole appeared on her summit, the vestige of a vertical shaft dug by miners supervised by Edward Drax in 1776, the first of 3 major insults to her body over the next 200 years. In the mid-19th century, Dean Merriweather dug in from the side, and Richard Atkinson followed suit in the 1960s, filmed by the BBC. Each was a bid to reveal her mystery, to give bone to the local legend of King Sil lying in his gold at her core, still mounted. Given the cumulative effect of these tunnels and voids, she was considered in danger of collapse. The hill did not collapse. But by May 2008, the hole and tunnels had been filled in with £500,000 of crushed and liquefied chalk, sealing her for good. And Silbury now looks better than ever, partly because no one is allowed to climb her, let alone to dig into her. The scars of many puffing visitors are pretty well healed. There is no longer a chalk-white, foot-battered walk-up. Our contemplation of her is not spoilt by little figures in blotches of bright rainwear labouring up the slopes. She is sacred again. She is not to be approached. She has, in fact, been designated a site of special scientific interest, mainly because of her flowers, particularly for the rare knapweed broomrape flowering on a tall, thick stem that tapers towards the bottom. It resembles a giant pipe cleaner, or what sax players call a shove-it. Now it can flourish untrampled on the slopes of its equally weird hill. Silbury is not, of course, without prehistoric companions on the downs of Wiltshire and Berkshire. She lies in an area whose 9 square miles includes Avebury Henge, the Sanctuary, the two great avenues, East and West Kennet Long Barrow, Windmill Hill, Marlborough Mound, and various barrow cemeteries. But tumuli and stone circles and long barrows, while impressive, are simply not as, well, quirky-looking. It is astonishing that she can no longer be climbed, in fact. When at school, at Marlborough College, 5 miles up the road, and later when living on the Downs, I climbed Silbury many times myself, and on a few occasions since. These days, this hill of memories is a fragile museum exhibit. All she lacks is a glass case. Gone are the times when fingers closed on her tussocks, the giggling downland lass struggling up with her pimply courting lad, who wonders whether to give her a hand and then does so, feeling the softness of her palm with its farm-working calluses against his own dry roughness, the bodily weight of her jerky tug, which is something extraordinary. And then, as he slips over on a smear of sheep droppings, the same weight bundling past, as if she has turned into laughing air just yards from the summit, and him cursing happily because he is so happy when all's right with the world, despite his right mitten being in a stink of clot. A pastoral scene that happened thousands of times over, and will happen no more. Yet let's not be sentimental about this either. I doubt just anyone would have been allowed to climb Silbury when she was sacred, in whatever way she was sacred. Now she is sacred in a very downbeat, sensible, 21st century way, a scientific and secular way. Rustling suppositions, stories unravelling. Imagination thrives on mystery. The Puritan landowners and farmers, who, out of genuine belief or straightforward greed, or a canny mixture of both, brought down most of the standing stones and flattened numerous tumuli in the area's immediate ritual landscape, liked neither mystery nor the fructifying imagination. It is depressing that this extraordinary landscape, of which Silbury may have been the symbolic centre, did not exert a more positive pull on their vision of life. But if, Taliban-like, they believed, as did their medieval forerunners, that the stones and barrows were the devil's work, this was not the result of imagination so much as logic. These bizarre elements in the landscape were not Christian, ergo they were heathen. Avebury and Stonehenge are built mostly in sarsen stone, this being a type of sandstone harder than granite. Sarsen is a corruption of Saracen. The destruction of these temples was, therefore, a type of crusade. When the so-called Sanctuary, a magnificent stone circle on nearby Overton Hill, was ripped out by the terrible Farmer Green in 1724, the other locals were very upset. Maybe there were quite a few who practiced pagan ways, whether or not they were church-going. Or maybe their internal landscape was wedded to the outer. Their memories so bound up with the earth and place that to see this great ripple of stones removed in a matter of days hurt them psychically in some way. But Green owned land and was part of a matrix of local power that was unassailable. I see labouring men and women lining the entrance to the sanctuary, spreading out their ranks. Green clops up on his horse, scattering flints from the hooves. He is a plump, red-faced, Hogarthian figure in a tricorn hat and double-breasted coat. He might not have been plump, of course. He might have been cavernously thin, consumed by covetousness and a Puritan zeal. It was William Stukeley, without whose painstaking records we would know much less about the Avebury complex, who recorded the general sorrow in his book Avebury, A Temple of the British Druids with Some Others Described, 1743. This Overton Hill was, alas, it was, a very few years ago, crowned with a most beautiful temple of the Druids. They still call it the sanctuary. The loss of this work I did not lament alone, but all the neighbours, except the person that gained the little dirty profit, were heartily grieved for it. It had a beauty that touched them far beyond those much greater circles in Avebury town. I see the pitchforks shake and rise a little as Green and his henchmen approach, like the bad guys in a western. His eyes flicker to the circle of sarsens in that tilth, that fertile acreage of which he has already calculated the profit. Not dirty at all to him. But something else drives him. He is addicted to pulling out the stones, the rotten teeth of the land, to reducing the devilish ache. He has extracted so many already that he feels lighter in his head. He sleeps more easily, despite his poor digestion, his tendency to wind. He smells of sweat, manure, and the cologne his wife brought from her London trip. She fancies his work is dangerous, that it meddles with the devil, and that a stone might crush him, or a part of him, flat. But like so many individuals with or without psychopathic leanings, he justifies his destruction by saying it is God's work. He even believes it himself. They say he has plans to flatten Silbury Hill, visible from here as a mere wart to the west. In truth, this is more a fantasy than a plan. He dreams of it at night, when he lies awake beside his snoring wife. This is the man confronting the rabble. But when the mob start to throw stones, his henchmen flee. He is pulled off his horse and cuffed and kicked, barely escaping with his life. The beautiful ripple of stones is saved from its sleep of some 4,000 years or more and remains intact to our day. Farmer Green, dying of apoplexy soon after. Alas, this is a counterfactual fantasy. Nobody took action in 1724. Cowed as they were by the local power patterns and by the general fashion for destruction, its fierce self-righteousness having a bit more edge than the status quo of leaving well alone, leaving things as they had always been, letting the grass grow long around the stony feet, where the sheep nibble in the shadow out of the wind. Century after century.
Philip Franks was reading from On Silbury Hill by Adam Thorpe. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. After the news, Woman's Hour on female TV directors, why are there so few, and giving up sugar, should we? Jane Garvey will be here in a couple of minutes.
People will always assume that a woman is not the minister, and so although it's right to be friendly and approachable, don't you forget you're the minister, or else they certainly will.
For BBC Radio 4, senior politicians reflect on their life and times. This week, Roy Hattersley.
Until I was 17 or 18, I knew I was Labour, but I couldn't have told you in more than a couple of sentences why I was Labour.
Reflections with Peter Hennessy. On Wednesday at 9 o'clock in the morning, and again in the evening at 9:30.